Ho ho ho! Merry Christmas! Happy Hanukkah! Festive Kwanzaa! Wonderful winter solstice! Ramadan? Let's have some fun!
Ba-da-ba-ba, ba-da-ba-ba. Alright. Mode 101, 12 nights of Christmas.
Hi, this is Rick Schultz from The Autograph Source on Promoter 101.
Happy Christmas Eve, friends. It's Promoter 101. It's the 12 Days of Christmas Super Spectacular Fun Podcast. Each day between December 20th and 31st, we'll be doing a special featured with a brand new interview. And here to unveil who that's going to be is my co-host and friend, William Lucas Pierce.
That's right. We finally reveal what the W is for all along here, Dan. It is my first name, William. And I'm very glad to be here on the fifth day of 12 Days of Christmas on Promoter 101. Between December 20th and the 31st, we've been featuring an interview from a featured guest you've not heard before, an abridged version of Promoter 101. And today, our featured guest is Benji Gulp. He's going to detail his path from punk rock to hip hop and how it led him to this great cannabis gold rush we're all in right now, Dan.
Hi, this is Heath Miller.
Becca Leifer.
Ed Mike Cohn.
Derek Dimenstein.
Jason Kupperman.
Jason Miller.
John Scher.
Marcia Vlasic.
Mike Fruitman. Ricardo Baca.
Peter Schwartz.
Nick Storch.
I'm on Promoter 101.
Promoter 101.
I'm on Promoter 101.
We continue our world tour. Catch us when we come to a town near you.
Next on deck for Promoter 101, we'll be live at the FlyCon conference in the Big Easy, New Orleans, January 16th at 2 p.m. We'll be recording Promoter 101 live with a special guest from Lockin and the Brooklyn Bull, Mr. Peter Shapiro. Looking forward to it, Dan.
Yeah, and you can follow us on Twitter. I'm at The Jew. The show's at Promoters 101, and it's plural, Promoters with an S, 101. And you can always catch Luke at W. Luke Pierce.
Of course, it's Dan and I talking every week. You hear enough of us, but it doesn't have to be that way. We're ready to listen. Send us an email with your ideas to steiny@promoter101.net. We can't wait to hear what's on your mind, and we give you our sworn promise to respond to every inquiry in a timely manner because you matter to us.
Hi, it's Ed Mike Cohn. I'm on Promoter 101.
Our featured guest for day five of Promoter 101, 12 Days of Christmas, has so much to offer. Benji Gulp coming up through the world of punk rock to hip hop. Now he's at the forefront of the cannabis gold rush that we're all experiencing right now, Dan. We're welcome to the podcast, Benji Gulp.
Promoter 101, we are in Denver, Colorado, and I am joined by an old friend, Benji Gulp in the house.
What's up?
Dude, it is just like old times.
It's 1993, 94 in Welton Street all over again.
Man, Muddy's is still open. I'm hanging posters on poles.
15th Street Tavern was like right over there where P.F. Chang's is.
I'm hanging Lagwagon posters outside a 7 Second show that I've way oversold at the Mercury Cafe.
The Vandals and...
This is funny because I saw some of the old posters recently. Mercury Cafe, Vandals headline, strung out in the middle spot, opening, Blink. Pre-Blink 182, that was an $8 show.
I saw some of the coolest shows at the Mercury Cafe. I saw it was Mike Watt was headlining. And Eddie Vedder and his wife were in Hovercraft. The Foo Fighters were in the middle, main support or whatever. And there was a line around the building, but this was, I want to say it was still like 1995.
Yeah, I guess we should talk about your career.
In ninth grade, I was in a video class and I waited 6 weeks. I waited till the very last moment to turn to my video project. And I had a Billboard magazine in my backpack in ninth grade because I was into Billboard. And in the video lab, they had MTV. I looked in the Billboard and I was like, okay, cool. I'm going to take the top 10 of the charts. I'm going to take the video off of MTV. I'm going to play 10 seconds of the number one song in whatever the chart is. I basically taped Madonna, maybe The Cure, and maybe Elvis Costello. And I played the top 10 U.S. singles in the country, and it was Madonna. The top 10 albums, and it was like Bon Jovi. Then I profiled Depeche Mode.
So you basically did TRL Live before it existed.
Yeah, it was like Wayne's World before. Yeah, TRL or Wayne's World or whatever. And the teacher, I thought he was going to give me like an F. And Mr. Nealon, he was my ninth grade video teacher. And he said to me, he said, hey, this is really cool. Do you want to do this, you know, every week? And I was like, sure. So, you know, here I was, 15 years old, and I thought, wow, this is a really cool way to maybe get free music and to get to go to shows and meet bands. And that was always a dream. So I remember Bobby Brown was playing at RPI. I was from Albany, New York, playing with Karen White and Canine Posse. And I called up that day. I remember calling up, and whoever answered the phone at the time, I said, hey, can I get press privileges for today? Some 15-year-old kid. And they put me on the phone with the road manager. And the road manager was like, you need to call the record label or you need to call management. I was like, wow, I can do that in the future. So Slick Rick was coming to town at the Palace Theater. And I wanted to meet Slick Rick. So I called up Rush Artist Management. And I spoke to his manager, Lindsay Williams, at the time. And Lindsay thought it was great. This 15-year-old kid wants to interview Slick Rick and put him in a suburban high school.
You didn't hide that at all, that you were a high school kid. You, like, owned it.
They embraced it. They thought it was cool. MTV Raps was only 30 minutes a week, so they had no other exposure. So they were looking for any way to get their videos out there. Even if it was in the homeroom of, you know, a kid up in upstate New York, and if it was on public access, the more the merrier. The only people that really were working with me were rap labels and rap artists. Sure enough, I got that interview with Slick Rick and continued to do a lot of stuff with a lot of rappers. Then I did some rock stuff. Then I decided to come out to college in 1993 to go to University of Denver. And I remember going to all these shows and Mike Drum was there. And a lot of the label folk would tell me, hey, you know, you and Drum should link up and he does this and he's doing all this. And I was, at that point, I was kind of changing. And I was really into hardcore music and I was very anti-corporate. And some of these record labels were offering me money to play music videos. And some of them offering me money to do things. And I kind of got turned off by the labels. And I was so anti.
Isn't that technically illegal too? It's the same thing as payola, isn't it?
I mean, I don't know if that ever applied to the video, especially to public access, but
I would think particularly to public access.
Whatever it was, I didn't want to embrace it. And I was kind of hesitant. And then I remember going to the shows and seeing Mike at these shows. And I kept saying to myself, that could be me. That could be me. I didn't even want to deal with like any of the record labels because they were so corporate. You know, at the time, you know, Ice-T was going through the whole Body Count controversy with the record label pulling the record and being afraid. And I think that Hollywood Records and Insane Clown Posse was kind of around the same time. And these were people or these were companies that were caving in. And at the time, I was so, and I was still uneducated in life and I hadn't gotten wise. But at that time, I just didn't, you know, want to have anything to do with those kinds of companies. And so I just put it all to the side and I stopped doing that. And that was Mike Drum's story.
Before we leave the Mike Drum thing, I quickly want to point out that Denver was a rare market that not only had live video show that was based here, we had two. We had Teletoons as well. Teletoons was the cool kids doing it. Mike had much better production values, but the beautiful, hot, cool people were on the other show.
I totally forgot about Teletoons, and they had that kind of like rainbow logo too.
It changed throughout the years, but Warlock Pictures wouldn't have been as big as they were if it wasn't for Teletoons. But let's digress back into your career. You're a fan, you're working in the industry. How did that lead to your world of tour managing?
So what happened was I was in college. So I was working at KS104, kind of before they became KS107.5. They were only playing, you know, rap music. And the rap music at that time was like Salt and Pepper and Kid and Play. It was only after 8 o'clock at night. Right down the hall was 92X. And I was hired just as a board op. I was just hired to play Casey Kasem or Rick Dees or whatever it was. And play carts and music. And I wasn't supposed to talk. At the time, I had piercings in my face. My hair was blue. And my program director just was like, dude, you know, you should probably not come to any of our events. And 92X, which is still to this day the greatest radio station of all time, was right down the hall. And I became buddies with this guy, Zach. Zach and I would just hang out all the time. We'd go downstairs and smoke cigarettes. We'd talk about music. We both shared the same love for the same kind of music at the time. And 92X was playing that kind of music. Zach and I just maintained a friendship. And then he introduced me to a woman who was working at RCA Records at the time. And then she put me in touch with the guys at Loud Records. And Loud, which is Steve Rifkin and Rich Isaacson. Rich Isaacson was running the label in New York, and he had asked me to go meet the Wu-Tang Clan up at the Fox Theater. And he was interested in maybe, I think this was 96, me going out with the Wu-Tang Clan on Lollapalooza, because I had that image with my face, and because Zach had introduced me to this woman at RCA, and then RCA was distributing Loud. And I went up to Boulder, and I met a couple of the guys in the Wu-Tang Clan. And I was just like, there's no way I could do this. There's no way I could go on tour with these guys. Absolutely not.
They're a circus on the road even now. They've gotten it together a little bit. But back then, they missed as many shows as they made. I mean, they even got kicked off the Rage Against the Machine tour because they were missing shows.
Yes. And so I met these guys and I couldn't do it. They were like, well, we've got this other group called the Alcoholics. They're going out on the Warped Tour. and it was the Warped Tour of 96. It was the second Warped Tour. I met them and they were super cool. The Alcoholics at the time, we had Exhibit with us and he had just put out a song called Paparazzi. We went out on the Warped Tour and it was me, the Alcoholics, and Exhibit. And actually our DJ at the time wasn't with us. He was in New York. He was working on another record. And our DJ at the time was Otis from the Loop Pack, who is now, I believe he's Kanye West DJ, it's Madlib. He goes by Madlib and Quasimodo, one of the greatest DJs and producers out there. We just had a great summer, and basically what it was the time when rap and rock were going to cross over, but the Alcoholics were how I got started in touring.
And that led to who?
I swore I was never going to tour ever again with a rap group, and then I moved to Los Angeles in the early 2000s, around 2001, and Norwood Fisher from Fishbone showed up at my door and he said, "Hey man, you ready to fuck with Fishbone?" I love those guys and I had met them on the Warped Tour and I thought they were the coolest guys. And I said, sure. I spent some time with those guys. They taught me a lot of different things, a lot of good things, a lot of things that probably hurt their career in earlier days. You know, to this day, I still think that Angelo Moore is like the greatest soul singer of our generation. I think he's probably one of the greatest frontmen. I know how many bands have been influenced by them and a lot of bands that don't even realize that they were influenced by Fishbone.
You can put Party on Ground Zero on anywhere and everyone will sing along. That song is entrenched in our music history. And I truly believe that song is what brought that second wave of ska into play.
I think that you're right, because I think that bands like Madness and The Specials and English Beat, because Party at Ground Zero was like late 70s, early 80s. And what Fishbone was doing primarily was definitely introducing this ska music to California, I guess, with the beach. They were in that movie Back to the Beach with Frankie and Annette.
Jamaican ska, da 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 da, ska, ska, ska. You didn't think I was going to know that, did you?
I think it's even great. That's actually why I'm smiling right now, because I think it's so great that you actually... They were actually in a lot of great movies. They were the backing band in I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka.
I didn't know that. I obviously didn't know the Frankie and Annette story, because that was the last beach movie ever made.
Really?
Well, yeah. I mean, and clearly people have probably tried to knock it off, but Frankie and Annette were the franchise, and they came back 25 years later to redo one more movie and Back to the Beach and had everybody, Bob Denver and Gilligan, and it's like the guys from Leave It to Beaver, you know, it was like Jerry Mathews and Tony Dow, it was like, and Barbara Billingsley, like they were the judges for the surf competition.
And I was excited to see this movie in theaters. I remember going to see it probably the weekend it came out, though.
I still have it on VHS.
You probably have me beat on that, because I definitely don't have that on VHS, but I do have every Gary Coleman movie on VHS.
The big prank was he's the big kahuna, but nobody could get it right throughout the whole movie. You're the big chihuahua. It's kahuna.
Wow. Now I gotta go back and pay attention to Back to the Beach. Hopefully Netflix has it streaming.
That's gonna be the Promoter 101 movie of the week. Back to the Beach with Frankie and Annette. You can get that hopefully on Netflix.
Back to the Beach.
We digress, back to your career. Sorry.
So I worked with Fishbone for a little while. In my music video day, when I was doing this cable TV show, some of the people that were sending me the videos, there was a team that was hired. And it was my buddy Gordon, who later became my buddy Gordon, and my buddy Laz. And Laz and I would always dream about going on tour. And then Laz, he was in a band called El Nino.
Metal band.
Latin metal band. So I was friends with Laz, and the drummer Dave Chivari and I had known each other for a little while. He was in MOD, Methods of Destruction, and he was in Propane. He was actually a few years earlier, he was in Laz Rocket and Gothic Slam. Dave used to nag me when I was still living here in Denver. He used to call me up. He was in Propane. And he used to call me up and say, "Dude, you got to get me shows for Propane." And then finally, El Nino was touring. And he said to me, "Hey, man, I know that, you know, you hustle and blah, blah, blah. So you interested in coming out with El Nino?" And I thought it was going to be the greatest thing. I thought it was going to be the coolest thing. I thought it was going to be the easiest thing. But it was an education for sure. And I spent some good years with those guys. Those guys are still my best friends.
The metal world works differently than anything else. Those guys run real production. Punk rock and rap have always been a looser business. It's the attitude of we don't give a fuck. We're just here to fucking have a good time and play some shows. Does not exist in metal. Those guys are there to put on a musically intense show. And as hard and difficult as it sounds when you're listening to it, those guys are musicians at the highest level, and they take their craft and their production of their show seriously. So that's, I always appreciated that as a kid, because when I was booking the Blink and the Vandal shows and the No Doubt shows, which were more laid back, I was also doing Cannibal Corpse and 6 Feet Under and Morbid Angel. I saw both sides of it. And when I did metal shows, I needed stage clearance and bigger production and always a better sound system, because those guys could blow a system.
That, and you know, one of the things was that I learned early on was that lights, the LD was super important. Actually, one of our LDs is now, you know, running lights for Metallica. He was very important to our show. You got to give your audience their money's worth.
And tickets were always more expensive in metal too, so that really mattered. Punk rock shows that for us were $8 to $12, depending on, I mean, No Effects Face to Face and 10 Foot Pole at the Gothic was a $10 show, and that was expensive. And when I did a $13 ticket for the first time, I took so much shit from the community. And you know what? I've never actually addressed this, but I think you could acknowledge this. Promoter doesn't set the ticket price. The manager and the agent do.
That was another thing. You know, here you were. You're trying to have, with one of the bands I was working with, they were trying to have $15 tickets. They wanted a bigger guarantee and they wanted catering.
Right,
and
that stuff has to come from somewhere, because there's only so much money at 10 bucks. A $15 ticket allows us to produce a better show.
Exactly. And, you know, there's a reason why tickets have to go up. And I learned that because I didn't understand that. And I used to get upset.
I got called some very bad things by a lot of people that I respected when I just wanted to bring the band to town that was going to come to town one way or another. It was just, I was the one that happened to get the show and I was destroying punk rock. And all I was thinking was, man, I'm the only one bringing punk rock. What are you talking about? I'm bringing the community together.
But you're always going to have those haters. I mean, that was...
Yes, I was 18 years old and learning firsthand. And I probably could have handled that a lot better had I been a little bit more skilled and worldly. But I was an 18-year-old kid. It was just like, fuck you, I'm bringing punk rock.
Weren't you one of the first people that brought Brainiac here?
You know, I'm sure they came before I did them because they're a little bit ahead of my time. But certainly love working with those bands. And we did a lot of shows with nobody in particular. And Doug was a mentor and a partner. And let's jump ahead. You took a switch. And you've done something that a lot of the industry has started to do, and you've jumped into the cannabis world.
I lost my passion for music. Here I was, when I was a kid, I would make everyone listen to whatever I was listening to. And if I thought it was cool, you had to think it was cool. And I would force it down everyone's throat. And historically, I had great taste in music, I'm not going to lie. And I lost passion around 2011, 2012. I just lost the passion. I developed this rap artist from Houston, Texas, and we did a lot of work, and he was a rapper, and we actually got to number 40 on Active Rock Radio. But it was a big process, and you know, I had this kid playing on festival stages, but it was a kid I found on MySpace and completely developed. We had a lot of hype, especially in the UK. Put together a great record produced by Ross Robinson, had one of the guys from At The Drive-In playing in his band, had two of the guys from the Blood Brothers playing in his band. It was panning out. I just think that he didn't want to continue with the rock thing anymore. He wanted to do more rap, beat-oriented music.
And this was the moment where like Linkin Park was like crushing it on mixing both sides, right?
It was a few years later, but yeah, I mean, it was, so this was around 2000, between 2007 and 2012.
Were you seeing guys like Eminem tour with like System of a Down? Like those moments were happening then?
Yeah, I mean, you know, because he was getting hit up by Fred Durst, and he was getting hit up by Travis Barker and Monkey, and Jonathan Davis from Korn went on, you know, Revolver magazine saying that it was his favorite album of the year. You know, there was a lot of that love. I mean, Jacoby Shaddix would come up to him at shows and POD guys would hit him up. And like I said, it wasn't necessarily in his heart. And I, as a younger kid, I think as a younger person, I was more willing to promote anything that was associated with a friend or something that I was associated with in the beginning. But I just lost the passion. I just completely lost the passion.
So you decided that you had to switch fields and find something you were excited about.
Yeah, I mean, actually, he was a guy that we went on tour with Fishbone. He's a great ska tour manager now. His name is Ed Boning. Ed one day said to me, he said, look, dude, he goes, I never feel like I'm working when I'm on the road. Because, you know, my father taught me that you don't work any day, you know, or you don't work a day in your life if you enjoy what you do. And that's how I felt with bands. Like, even when I'd be in Europe with a band and, you know, a bus wouldn't show up or something and I would stress out, I still didn't feel like I was working. When I lost the passion for music, it just felt like it was work to me.
You have this burnout moment. How did that transition you into weed? You left the industry, clearly.
A buddy of mine, actually, here in Colorado, had been one of the first people to get a medical permit to license marijuana to distribute and to sell in a medical facility. He had been hitting me up for a long time to come out here and do it, and there was always a stigma attached to marijuana. People still looked at it as a drug, and especially when you have the reefer madness mentality of making people think that marijuana is more harmful than it truly is, and, you know, withholding education or not necessarily presenting facts. And I was hesitant to get into it, and I was wondering, how am I going to tell my mother or my nana that I'm working in marijuana? It took me a few years to finally decide to do it. And then finally, I was working in a dispensary. My buddy had a dispensary, and we were...
What were you doing in the dispensary?
I was kind of overseeing just about everything. I mean, I wasn't bud tending because I tried to bud tend one day and a customer asked me a question. I couldn't speak intelligently enough about it, and I would be frustrated if I was the customer. So I just decided I would never help customers because I didn't want to give them the wrong information, because we were both recreational medical, so I could see it from both angles.
You've moved into the field, but you've become much bigger than just working in a dispensary.
I learned a lot about the business. So here I was, like I said, I didn't want to help customers because I wasn't educated. I actually did learn a lot about the business. And I learned from both angles. I learned from the pros and the cons, the people that were opposed to it, the people that were proponents of it. And I want to see how the people that were opposed to it, how could they think like that? And I also want to see why the proponents were so hardcore into believing. And I've seen it. I remember seeing patients. There were sick patients that would come in, and you could tell that this was definitely taking away a lot of pain. These people were actually being helped.
So let's talk about where the industry's going, because a lot of the people that work from the music industry side of things have transitioned, just like you have, into that marijuana legal business.
What I'm seeing a lot of now are a lot of current or ex music industry folk are investing into California, Oregon, Washington. Right now we're down in Puerto Rico. As the states particularly go recreational, like California, Colorado, Washington, Alaska, Oregon, Nevada, I think that you're going to start seeing more and more people are going to get into the business, and they're going to start seeing that there are other ways to put their creativity or whatever drove them into the music business as young adults or young teenagers or whatever it was. It's the same mentality with cannabis now, but the difference is you're helping people. People are actually benefiting from it. Those that are using it recreational, they're enjoying it. They're getting clean, safe product. You know, I think it's more accepting to eat a cookie and go to a concert now than 20 years ago. I think that it's a lot different.
Everyone knows someone that smokes pot in Colorado, if not 40 people. Is being a pothead not the same thing?
No, I mean, I think that people, there are still those that don't smoke marijuana. And there are still those that still look at potheads as the typical.
Because, I mean, everybody's pothead used to be the bus driver from The Simpsons, right? Otto was the guy. But now it's like you just as likely see Homer shopping for it, if not like Smithers, you know?
Ned Flanders would also shop for it right now.
Howdy ho, God grown.
The people that are buying marijuana are everybody. You've got cops, you've got lawyers, you've got doctors, you've got young adults, men, women, grandparents. Everybody. I don't think there's any demo that's not touched by cannabis. And like you said, everyone knows somebody that does. I think it's just some people don't want to admit it. You know, I remember years ago, Roseanne Barr said, everyone says they don't smoke weed, but really everyone does. I think that that's still going on today. I've seen a lot of heavy hitters in the music business that are putting millions of dollars into cannabis. You've also got the licensing. You've got Rihanna. You've got Snoop Dogg. You've got Melissa Etheridge, Wiz Khalifa. You got people that are putting out their own branded strains, their own branded cartridges. Devil Driver has a cartridge. Testament has a cartridge.
If you smoke Testaments and you go see them now, does that make them good?
I think that Chuck Billy just looks like he did back in like 1986. I've never tried their oil, but I did enjoy seeing Testament the last time I saw them live.
Hey, man, I want to thank you so much for taking the time. It was great to walk down memory lane with you.
Right on. Thank you, Dan.
Promoter 101 in Denver with Benji Gold.
Benji's always got a rabbit up his sleeve. He is a mind at work. Happy to count him as a long-term friend.
Lucy Lawler-Freese, Rival Entertainment and the Fox Theater in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm on Promoter 101.
Hey, if you want to reach out to us, send us an email at steiny@promoter101.net.
And that brings us to the end of day 5 of Promoter 101, 12 Days of Christmas. If you haven't been tuning in, we've been doing abridged versions of Promoter 101 just to keep the fix in during the holiday season, give you something each and every day to get away while you're working out or away from your family or traveling. So this is day 5. That means there's 7 days. It's one whole week left. Special interviews you've never heard before on Promoter 101. Make sure you tune in tomorrow, day 6, to hear who's next.
Until then, we're wishing you sold out shows.
Cheers, motherfucker.
Hey, this is Craig Newman. For all you lovers out there, turn on the AM radio,
Put down your inhibitions and pick up a cool glass of Promoter 101.
Let's have some fun!
Ba-da-ba-ba, ba-da-ba-ba. All right.
Promoter 101, 12 Nights of Christmas.